KPBS On Demand is supported by UC San Diego, offering the online Master of Data Science program, a journey through computation, data analysis, and real-world applications. Learn more about the online Master of Data Science program from UC San Diego at omds.ucsd.edu.
This week on KPBS Roundtable, former San Diego County Supervisor Nathan Fletcher has been using campaign money to fund his defense against sexual assault allegations, and the move is raising eyebrows.
So I think there's a real question as to whether or not this is a legal use of campaign funds. And this is a case where we're potentially pushing the lines of what is allowed.
Then, a state audit released this week casts doubt on the effectiveness of California's homelessness spending. That and our weekly roundup, coming up next on Roundtable.
KPBS On Demand is supported by UC San Diego, offering the online Master of Data Science program, shaping the next generation of data-driven problem solvers. Learn more about the online Master of Data Science program from UC San Diego at omds.ucsd.edu.
Welcome to KPBS Roundtable. I'm Scott Rodd. Former San Diego County Supervisor Nathan Fletcher has been fighting a sexual assault lawsuit in court since last year and spending campaign funds to do it. Plus, a state audit found big problems with how the city of San Diego tracks spending on homelessness. The KPBS Roundtable starts now. A little over a year ago, Nathan Fletcher was the leading candidate to replace Senator Tony Atkins in the state Senate. But allegations of sexual assault and harassment led to him dropping out of that race and ultimately resigning his county supervisor seat. Former San Diego Metropolitan Transit System employee Gracia Figueroa accused Fletcher of multiple instances of sexual assault during her time at MTS and filed suit against him last year. Fletcher has denied the allegations and recently filed a defamation case against Figueroa in response. This week, we learn that Fletcher has been using campaign funds from his abandoned state Senate run to pay for his defense against those allegations. I'm joined by KPBS investigative reporter Amitha Sharma to discuss the latest in the case. Welcome back to Roundtable, Amitha.
Oh, it's good to be with you, Scott.
So let's start just at the ground level. Who is Nathan Fletcher?
Well, Nathan Fletcher is a guy whose story is just absolutely novelesque. He's a well-known and controversial political figure in this region, and you might argue even across the state. He's a former Marine who fought in the Iraq War. He served in the state assembly as a Republican and was widely seen as a rising star in the Republican Party. But then something really dramatic happened that earned him quite a few enemies. And that's back in 2011 when he entered the race for San Diego mayor. He was still a Republican at the time, but then the local Republican Party, the San Diego County Republican Party, decided to endorse his opponent, Carl DeMaio. And Fletcher then in 2012 said, "That's it. I'm going to leave the Republican Party. And I'm going to be an independent." A year later, after former San Diego Mayor Bob Filner resigned under a cloud of sexual harassment allegations, Fletcher decided to run again for mayor, but this time as a Democrat. He did lose. And then I think it's 5 years later in 2018, he ran for the Board of Supervisors and won from District 4. That's the seat that he resigned from after the sexual assault lawsuit was filed by former MTS worker Gracia Figueroa. And I should also mention that Fletcher is married to former state lawmaker Lorena Gonzalez.
So a political career that had its twists and turns, but certainly in recent years, he was continuing on that rise. But Fletcher's political ascent came to an abrupt halt last March when he suspended his campaign for state senate. And as you referenced, he faced a lawsuit for sexual assault allegations. Break down for us what happened.
Well, that abrupt halt that you just mentioned came with quite a bit of mystery, at least initially. In March of last year, Fletcher pretty much shocked everyone here in our political world in San Diego when he said that he was dropping out of the state Senate race. And that is a race that he was widely expected to win handily. He said that he was dropping out because he needed treatment for PTSD and alcohol abuse. Then, just a few days later, a woman by the name of Gracia Figueroa, who was a former spokesperson for the Metropolitan Transit System, filed a lawsuit. And she alleged that Fletcher sexually harassed her and sexually assaulted her. And then just one day after that surfaced, Fletcher said that he was resigning his seat from the Board of Supervisors.
And at the time, he was also the chairperson of MTS, and that's where their professional paths crossed. You've been following this lawsuit closely over the last 12 months. What's the latest on Figueroa's case against Fletcher?
Well, the two sides have reached a sticking point. Fletcher is trying to get Figueroa to turn over messages between Figueroa and a friend, or at least someone he calls a friend. He thinks that those messages might be exculpatory, that they might exonerate him somehow. Figueroa says that those messages are privileged because that so-called friend is actually her mental health counselor. And, you know, Scott, I should note that Figueroa herself told the judge that because she has separated from two different sets of lawyers. Now, there was a hearing before the judge in the case last Friday. As of that point, Figueroa still did not have a lawyer, but she did tell the judge that she plans to have new lawyers by the next hearing, and that is scheduled for April 26th. However, I should say, it does appear like the case might be at an inflection point. It's unclear why, as of a week ago, she still didn't have a new lawyer. And it's hard to imagine just how her lawsuit moves forward if she can't find one.
And there was an interesting development in recent weeks. Fletcher filed a countersuit against Figueroa alleging defamation. And it should be noted, Fletcher has consistently throughout this lawsuit claimed that this relationship was consensual. He's admitted that there was an extramarital affair, but he has said all of this has been consensual. You broke the story about the defamation lawsuit. What does it allege?
Yeah, Scott, as you said, he's filed this defamation complaint against Figueroa. And basically, he's saying that Figueroa was well aware that what happened between them was consensual. And he actually says that she was the one who initiated contact and went after him. Fletcher is saying that ultimately, Figueroa decided to use the interactions between them to extort millions of dollars from him, and that when he said no, she publicly accused him of sexual assault by filing this civil lawsuit against him. And he says that the effect of that lawsuit has really devastated his reputation, his career, and his ability to make money in the process. Figueroa, for her part, says that the complaint is meant to silence her. It's meant to drag out the case. And she basically says it's absurd and has no basis.
On the heels of the Me Too movement, there's been a spike in defamation lawsuits being filed by people accused of sexual assault against their accusers. You've looked into this a bit. Give us the broader context of what's been happening here nationwide. And how does Fletcher's defamation suit fit into this picture, or how is it different?
Well, first of all, there aren't really any hard numbers on how many of these defamation cases there are, but victims' rights advocates like this woman, Los Angeles law professor Victoria Burke, whom I spoke to yesterday, points to a Mother Jones piece a few years ago that found between 2014 and 2020, there were at least 100 defamation lawsuits that were filed in sexual assault cases or sexual harassment cases. Now, these cases really, or the defamation lawsuits really gained notoriety once the Me Too movement went viral in 2017. The concern about these defamation lawsuits is that they are basically retaliatory by the accused against the accuser. And for society at large, if you have these retaliatory lawsuits, you will never get to the truth of what's going on, because victims of sexual assault or sexual harassment will not speak out for fear of being financially crippled by one of these defamation lawsuits. It's basically cheaper for the victim to be silent and to go away quietly. Advocates say the reason for the spike in these defamation lawsuits around the time of the Me Too movement is because that's when people started to see really tangible consequences for the accused. Some of them were fired, some of them faced criminal charges, civil lawsuits, and some of them lost really lucrative contracts. So that's why advocates say these defamation lawsuits were being filed. As to where Fletcher's defamation lawsuit against Figueroa fits in to all of this, it's hard to tell, but he has offered up screenshots in his lawsuit of numerous text messages that appear to suggest, at least, that Figueroa's encounters with him were not against her wishes. Now, she has said, again, that nothing that took place between them was consensual. So, Scott, now it's my turn to ask you questions. I'm going to flip the table on you.
All right.
There was another development in this Fletcher case that you and I have been discussing. In fact, a story that you broke yesterday. You found that Fletcher has been using campaign money from his abandoned state Senate run to pay for his legal bills in the alleged sexual assault lawsuit. How much money are we talking about?
Well, legal bills in these cases can get real expensive, and Fletcher has spent $323,000 so far that we know about from his abandoned state Senate campaign. And there may be more. That was as of the end of 2023. So there's been another 3 months of proceedings. So that means probably more legal bills have piled up. But again, $323,000 is what we know he spent from his campaign so far.
Because when I hear numbers like this and I hear a move, you know, using campaign money to defend against sexual assault allegations, the natural question that surfaces is this legal? What does the law say about this?
Well, there are very specific rules around how you can use campaign money. However, the laws are also a bit squishy, and there's some room for interpretation. So I reached out to the California Fair Political Practices Commission, which is the commission that enforces and regulates campaign finance. And a senior legislative counsel there told me that, quote, a candidate, even if they withdraw from the primary, can expend campaign funds for purposes reasonably related to a political, legislative, or governmental purpose. She also said that if litigation is unrelated to the activities of the committee or campaign, campaign funds may not be used to pay for legal costs associated with that litigation. So fairly specific, but there's still a little squishiness and some room for interpretation.
So I know that we live in an entirely different political world these days. When someone contributes to a campaign, Scott, is the expectation now that, hey, some of this money might ultimately be used by the candidate or the one-time candidate to defend himself or herself in a lawsuit?
Yeah, I mean, one expert I spoke to, an expert on campaign finance, said, you know, buyer beware at the, you know, in this day and age, when you give money to a candidate, I agree. I think most people would assume that they're giving money for this person to represent them and their district in the state legislature or in whatever capacity they're running for. But, you know, this expert suggested that, yeah, in this day and age, you have to anticipate that that candidate could use the money however they see fit, as long as they believe that it fits into the state laws around campaign finance.
So what did those campaign finance experts say about the legality of Fletcher's expenditures?
Well, so the two campaign finance experts I spoke to said this falls into a bit of a legal gray area. I spoke with Jessica Levinson. She's a professor at Loyola Law School. And here's what she thought about Fletcher's use of campaign funds.
So I think there's a real question as to whether or not this is a legal use of campaign funds. And I think it's fair to say that this is probably not what the FPPC and those who drafted the statute intended. And this is a case where we're potentially pushing the lines of what is allowed.
I also spoke with Allison Hayward. She's a former commissioner on the FPPC. She also said that this appears to fall into a legal gray area, but she went a step further and said, you know, even if this is legal, in today's day and age where people are very cynical and jaded about politics and politicians, she said she doesn't think that Fletcher should have used this money to pay for his legal defense in this sexual assault case. Again, even if it was legal, she kind of drew an ethical line.
And so what does Fletcher have to say about these expenditures?
Fletcher's campaign attorney told me, hey, look, everything is legal here. We did everything by the book. He said that this lawsuit filed by Figueroa only happened because he was running for state Senate. And he claimed that without that candidacy, Figueroa wouldn't have filed the lawsuit. So they're looking at it as we're defending Fletcher in his capacity, in a sense, as his former Senate candidate, and that these campaign funds, as a result, should be open for use to defend Fletcher, since this was the thing that ended his candidacy essentially. And again, they're claiming that Figueroa would not have filed the suit had he not run for office.
And Scott, what are you keeping an eye on from here?
Well, I'm definitely going to keep an eye on further campaign finance filings from Fletcher to see, you know, if he spends more money on his legal defense and just how much. He's sitting on more than $500,000 in campaign contributions that are unspent. I'll also be looking to see if there's a Fair Political Practices Commission complaint filed against Fletcher, and then the commission may look into whether or not this use of campaign finance funds is allowed. I'm going to wrap this conversation up by taking the hosting hat back, if you don't mind, and ask you.
I'm handing it over to you.
Yes, thank you. I'm going to ask you the same question. What are you keeping an eye on from here?
I want to know, you know, is the case going to move forward? If so, how? What's going to happen to those text messages that Fletcher wants between Figueroa and her friend / mental health therapist? Is the judge going to force her to turn them over, or is he going to say, give them to me, I'll review them, and I'll make a determination as to whether they're privileged? So there's a lot to look out for.
Well, we'll be keeping an eye out for all of your reporting on this topic. Amitha Sharma is an investigative reporter with KPBS. Amitha, thanks for being here.
Oh, it's good to talk to you, Scott, as always.
When we come back, a newly released state audit looks into what's working and what isn't when it comes to California's spending on homelessness.
It basically found that across the board, neither the state nor those two cities studied can really accurately account for exactly how much was spent, where the money went, and whether it was spent on programs that ultimately were successful.
You're listening to KPBS Roundtable.
Hi, I'm Maya Tribulsi, news anchor for KPBS Evening Edition. At KPBS, we're storytellers, providing trusted, accurate news and information to our community. But not everyone realizes how important that is. And that's why we're asking you to tell that story during Public Media Giving Days. Share what inspires you on KPBS. Text, call, or post with hashtag PublicMediaGives. And thanks.
You're listening to KPBS Roundtable. I'm Scott Rodd. Earlier this week, the state auditor released a widely anticipated audit of California's homelessness spending. It found that California has failed to account for billions in funding for homelessness programs. California allocated $24 billion over a 5-year period to address homelessness, but the audit shows not much is known about the effectiveness of that spending, and it's resulting in calls for increased oversight and transparency. Marisa Kendall joins us now to tell us more about what the audit found. She covers homelessness for CalMatters. Marisa, welcome back to Roundtable.
Thanks for having me.
So this audit is composed of two parts, one looking at five statewide programs, and the other drills down on spending in two cities, San Diego and San Jose. So top line here, what did the audit find?
It basically found that across the board, neither the state nor those two cities studied can really accurately account for exactly how much was spent, where the money went, and whether it was spent on programs that ultimately were successful.
Again, the audit focused on five state programs. Break those down for us. What are the programs and how well are they working or not working?
Yeah, so out of the five programs studied, three of those, the auditor found there's just not even enough information to determine if they're working or not. And I think maybe most concerning is the Homelessness Housing Assistance and Prevention Program, otherwise known as HAP, which is really the state's main way of funding local homelessness programs, was one of the programs that they just could not determine if it's working or not.
Hearing that there just wasn't even enough information to go on is sort of baffling, just given how much money is going towards these efforts and how much it's talked about by state lawmakers, state leaders, and down at the local level. You know, two of those projects did show value, though, Project Home Key and the other focused on homelessness prevention. Tell us about those programs and what the audit found.
So Home Key was really one of Governor Gavin Newsom's signature programs, and it helps cities and counties buy existing buildings, hotels and other types of buildings, and turn them into homeless housing. And the auditor found that it was, quote unquote, likely cost effective. And it was really basing that basically on a monetary level. It's a lot less expensive to convert rooms into homeless housing under Home Key than it is to build them brand new from the ground up. The other program that was likely effective was a CalWORKS housing support program, which gives financial help to families who are homeless or at risk of becoming homeless. And the auditor found that is also much more cost effective because it's a lot less expensive to help prevent someone from losing their housing than it is to help them once they've already ended up on the streets.
Let's go back to those other three programs where the state auditor just didn't have enough information to really fully assess them. You know, help us understand those programs, what they were meant to do, but then also, like, what does that mean? I mean, did the state auditor just say, look, we can't assess these? Or were they able to identify and tease out at least some understanding of what was going on with the programs?
Yeah, so the three programs were the state's rental assistance program, which helped people pay their rent and other expenses during COVID, the Encampment Resolution Fund, which is another big Newsom program that's supposed to help cities and counties clear specific encampments, and the Homeless Housing Assistance and Prevention Program, which I mentioned, which is really kind of the main homelessness program in the state right now. The auditor basically said, look, we just don't have enough specific data to say yes or no if these are working. For example, the big funding program, the Homeless Housing Assistance and Prevention Program, the auditor studied those results for four major counties, and it found that nearly one third of people who left placements funded under that program left for quote unquote unknown destinations. And that data is so ambiguous, you know, who knows where those people went, that it makes it impossible to tell if it's working, according to the auditor.
Did those findings surprise you?
They did surprise me a little bit. You know, we often struggle getting data around homelessness. You know, that's always been a challenging part of my job. But I did expect a bit more of concrete answers from this audit, to be honest.
All right, let's talk about what the audit found in San Diego, because it did focus in particular, again, on two cities, San Diego and San Jose. The mayor and the city council here are constantly talking about their efforts to address and prevent homelessness. But what did the state auditor say about those efforts?
So San Diego was studied along with San Jose, and similar results were found in both cities. But San Diego has spent hundreds of millions of dollars and cannot exactly account for, you know, exactly how much was spent, where it went, and how well it's working, according to the auditor. The two of the main issues that the auditor found was that San Diego did not do a good job of collecting data to determine how well its contracted programs are working. So when the city pays a nonprofit or another contractor to run like a shelter program, for example. And also another big area is San Diego is really investing a lot in improving conditions in street encampments because, you know, the city doesn't have enough housing. We have large encampments. So the city is investing in things like medical care, showers, toilets, things like that for people living in these encampments. And there's not much data there apparently to show what kind of impact that's having.
Was San Diego identified as a test case to look at the start of the audit, or did it emerge in the course of the audit as an example of a city that was struggling to identify where money was going and how effective the spending was?
Yeah, so San Diego is sort of a surprise last-minute reveal. When this audit was first authorized, it was supposed to focus on statewide programs and on San Jose, and then the auditor was supposed to pick one other city to focus on. So various lawmakers were sort of lobbying for their cities, and San Diego was chosen. It does give sort of a good geographic mix. You know, we've got one Northern California city, one Southern California city, and they're both obviously large cities with big homeless populations.
So there are a lot of players in the equation when it comes to trying to address homelessness. You know, you have the federal government, you have state government, and then it trickles on down to local, and you have contractors. So what role do cities play in the effort to address homelessness? And why does it matter if a city can't say where all the money went?
Yeah, you know, there's been a little bit of sort of finger pointing back and forth in terms of who's to blame for tracking all this information. The main state agency that's tasked with this is the California Interagency Council on Homelessness. And in their statement, they said, well, you know, the cities are really responsible for tracking this information because they're the ones who are setting up and implementing these programs, you know, which is true. The cities and the counties generally receive the funds and then set up the programs and decide, you know, where the funds are going to go. But then Mayor Matt Mahan in San Jose sort of pointed the finger back at the state saying, look, we get a lot of different types of state funding from a whole plethora of different grants. And each grant has, you know, different requirements for reporting and metrics. And it's not always clear to us exactly, you know, what information we're supposed to be tracking and giving to the state.
Yeah, you know, I recall that big cities, you know, mayors from big cities were pushing, have been pushing for more money to address this problem. But I guess in this situation, more money, more problems, I guess, when it comes to at least tracking where that money goes. How has the city of San Diego responded to the audit?
Yeah, so San Diego Mayor Todd Gloria, in a statement, he really defended the city's approach to homelessness. He said the city has served more than 11,000 people last year. He basically said, you know, we can use this audit as a tool to understand how much more needs to be done. And then he did put in a plug for continued funding. He said, you know, we hope to impress on state leaders the need for adequate and ongoing funding for California's biggest cities. And that has long been a sticking point that the governor tends to parcel out, you know, just year by year, one-time grants rather than guaranteeing an ongoing permanent source of homelessness funding. And cities, counties, and nonprofits all across the state have really taken issue with that.
That's interesting. We can't tell you exactly where the money has gone, but we would like more of it, please. Contracted homelessness service providers are a big piece of the city's effort to reduce homelessness. Here's what PATH's Hanan Scrapper told KPBS Metro reporter Andrew Bowen earlier this week.
It also really focuses on trying to meet people's basic human needs, right? Like our outreach teams have water and food and blankets and clothing and like first aid kits on them so that as you're encountering people, you're able to really start with like building trust by meeting their basic human needs.
And, you know, as providers are trying to address those basic human needs, it's also difficult to track and get accurate data on who they are, where they've been, and where they're going. You know, why is it so hard for agencies to track data on homelessness? And when that data is collected, what is the quality like?
It is difficult to gather data on homeless communities. Even the point in time count, which is a census of our homeless populations, is really problematic, and it's really just an estimate of how many people there are. It's really hard to count people. And when I gather data from various nonprofits serving the homeless community, especially when they talk about exit data, you know, tracking where people went when they exited a homeless shelter or some type of housing program, I often see a quote unquote unknown destination. And it's hard to know why that is, if it's because the person leaving didn't say where they're going, or if it's because the nonprofit didn't ask.
How does San Diego compare to how other cities and counties are tracking spending and outcomes on homelessness?
Well, it got very similar results to how San Jose is doing. A lot of the problems that were presented in San Diego were also obvious in San Jose, according to the audit. And one of the legislators I talked to about this said, you know, if this is going on in those two large cities, you know, we can almost guarantee this is happening in other cities throughout California. But the audit really only focused on those two.
Will there be any follow-ups that look at other cities? Do you know?
There's no follow-up like this planned, but I think now that this has come out, you know, a lot of people are talking about this, I think there's a lot of interest now in sort of adding more oversight to California's homelessness strategies. So I wouldn't be surprised if there were other audits. There is another audit planned, you know, separate from this, not through the state, but there's another audit being planned in Los Angeles, for example.
On the topic of oversight, the audit calls on agencies to better track and report on homelessness spending. What would that look like? And when might that better tracking become a reality?
Yeah, so the audit put forward several recommendations that it wants the state and the two cities to implement by September. And those included things like, you know, creating one unified place where all of this data would go and beefing up their various tracking measures. Both San Jose and San Diego responded saying they already have taken certain steps to try to improve things. San Diego, for example, has hired a couple people that are supposed to deal with this type of oversight.
What's been the overall response to the audit's findings from state leaders and lawmakers?
I think it depends if you are a Republican or a Democrat. Two of the legislators who really pushed for this audit, one was Republican Josh Hoover in the Assembly, and he said, you know, we really need to pause spending on homelessness until we can get to the bottom of this. And Senator Dave Cortese, who's a Democrat, he had the opposite response. He said, you know, the homelessness crisis is so bad, now is not the time to stop spending. But I do think we might see some bills in the legislature this session that sort of deal with this issue of accountability and try to codify some of the audit's recommendations.
Has Governor Newsom weighed in on this issue?
He has not. When I reached out to his office for comment, I was redirected to the California Interagency Council on Homelessness.
There's been a good amount of reaction from public officials to the audit, maybe not from Governor Newsom, but from others. What have you been hearing from readers and from just Californians in general about the audit's findings?
I think for people who were already really disillusioned with California's response to the homelessness crisis, you know, people who already were saying there's been so much money spent, but I walk down my street and conditions don't look any better. There's still giant encampments that I pass every day on my way to school or on my way to work. And, you know, our leaders are failing us. I think for those people, this audit really just proved their point. You know, it really vindicated what they were saying. And just sort of proved that the current process is not working.
So what comes next? You'd mentioned some potential legislation that may emerge. Is it possible that there could be reduced funding for homelessness in the upcoming state budget?
It's hard to know. I mean, it is a tricky budget year. You know, we have such a deficit. And in his initial proposal, Newsom didn't really slash homelessness funds that had already been promised, but he also didn't promise additional funds. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, what comes with that if this audit is used as an argument for defunding some of these programs.
I want to ask you about another story you published this week. This one talks about how San Diego's public encampment ban, which went into effect last summer, is being held up by some state lawmakers as a model that the state should adopt. But your story brings up questions about how effective the ban has been. What issues did your reporting find?
Yeah, so I went down to San Diego and really tried to investigate what was going on in the ground and how well the ban was working. And I found that, you know, while by some metrics it had been a success, you know, the number of tents downtown, for example, had been cut in half. By other measures, it was really less clear. You know, there were more people camping in other places, like along the riverbed, all along highway on and off ramps, which kind of suggests that people were being moved, but not necessarily having their homelessness ended.
You write that there are some key differences in what a proposed statewide encampment ban might look like versus what the city of San Diego did. Help us understand those differences.
Senator Brian Jones proposed Senate Bill 1011, which would essentially create a camping ban statewide that's really modeled closely off of San Diego's ban. So it would prohibit camping near schools and places like that, and it would prohibit even camping along sidewalks if there is shelter available. One key difference in that approach that Mayor Gloria pointed out is San Diego, at the same time it launched that camping ban, it also opened up some safe sleeping sites, which are basically, you know, city-sponsored giant tent camps where, you know, up to about 500 people can legally be in tents, and they have access to amenities like showers, toilets, and food. And the statewide bill would not require cities to do that. You know, Senator Jones said, I'm not going to mandate cities do something without providing the funding. But Mayor Gloria said, you know, that's really problematic because you can't just tell people where they cannot go. You have to provide somewhere for them to go.
But my understanding is Jones's bill has gotten some bipartisan support from Democratic lawmakers in Sacramento. Is that right?
It has. He has three Democratic co-authors, and it's going up for its first hearing next week. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there.
Yeah, we'll be keeping an eye on it for sure. All right. Marisa Kendall is a reporter with CalMatters covering homelessness in the state. Marisa, thanks for speaking with us today.
You're welcome.
Next up on Roundtable, we talk about some other stories we've been following this week on the weekly roundup. That's next on Roundtable. Welcome back to Roundtable. It's now time for our weekly roundup of stories we've been following. Joining me now is Andrew Bracken. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Scott.
First, top of the list, how was your solar eclipse experience?
To be perfectly honest, I was a little underwhelmed. And I know that's kind of like against popular opinion.
It is.
I mean, I even saw a headline saying, you know, everyone wowed by the eclipse.
This was the one thing that brought everyone in America together for a brief moment. And yet here you are.
Well, I'm sorry. I just didn't. Maybe if I was in the totality zone, I will say my wife really wanted to go to the zone of totality. But she injured her leg. We weren't able to travel. We couldn't put it together. So, you know, I was just working and went outside and took a look for a couple minutes. But I hate to say it. Yeah, I didn't know what to expect. I just, it didn't change my life.
Wow. You're zagging where everyone else zigged. I thought it was pretty cool. I made one of those little old school cereal box contraptions where you know, poke a hole in it and you look at the shadow. And I don't know, my fiance and I went outside halfway through the day and checked it out. And actually, as we were looking into the cereal box, some people were walking past and they wanted to look too. So it was actually kind of a cool neighborhood moment. So I am not nearly as jaded as you are about this.
And seeing the people, you know, in other parts where they're like on their lawn chairs or whole gatherings around it. I guess the other thing I didn't realize until now is that there are more solar eclipses to come. And I realized this one was special because it, you know, like completely threw the heart of the United States, parts of Mexico. But there's going to be another one in 5 years, granted in a different part of the world. But I didn't realize that either. I thought this was it for my lifetime.
You're over it. You are so jaded about this eclipse. Well, let's move on then. What else? What did get your attention this week? Because clearly the eclipse did not.
No. Well, one thing was There was a change in the San Diego County Republican Party. Paula Witzel was the chair up until earlier this week when she was replaced by Corey Gustafson. And it's a kind of a result of a little drama with the party's endorsement of a candidate in the primary election last month. They had endorsed Andrew Hayes for the 75th Assembly District over fellow Republican Carl DeMaio. And then Witzel had made an effort to change that endorsement to DeMaio. And from as a result of that, she's no longer chair.
It's interesting. Yeah. I mean, it is a very kind of like local story, but curious nonetheless. I actually covered this race for KPBS. And DeMaio came in a pretty strong first place, and Hayes actually almost lost the second place spot to go on to the general election to a Democrat. And this is a, you know, heavily Republican district. Mm-hmm. So maybe that factored into it, the fact that DeMaio, I think he had over 40% of the primary vote, and Hayes had closer to about 19%. So maybe that factored into it. But after having covered this race, I thought that that development was pretty interesting.
And you're right, both Republicans did make it, so they're going to stick with the endorsement for Hayes now. They're not going to change that, and we'll see. I mean, those party endorsements can boost candidates, so we'll see how that plays out. But, I mean, if you think you have some other political news for California as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that caught my eye this week is this Politico story that Javier Becerra, the current Health and Human Services Secretary under President Biden, is considering a run for governor in California in the 2026 election. He was previously the California Attorney General. And this is an interesting addition to what's already a crowded field. We have the Lieutenant Governor Eleni Koulounakis, who's said that she's interested in running. State Senator Tony Atkins, familiar name for folks down here in San Diego. She's thrown her hat in the ring. State Superintendent of Public Instruction Tony Thurman has also announced. And then there are others who are kind of hinting at it. So this is a crowded field, and this is, you know, this would be another big name already in a field of folks who have a lot of name recognition. It would also mean that Javier Becerra, if he does throw his hat in the ring, if he does, you know, win, he would be leaving the Biden administration. I think that would be a blow to the Biden administration to have your Health and Human Services Secretary, you know, bow out in order to go be governor somewhere else. So a lot of moving pieces to this story. It was very interesting to read about.
And still a couple years to go before that election. Obviously, we need to get through the presidential election in the fall. But still interesting to see how that's kind of shaping up already.
Yeah. You know, these things percolate for years in advance. It is interesting to see that. But for sure, the big hurdle of the 2024 election for all of us to get through for our sanity, that's first before we can start thinking about 2026. All right. What else were you reading this week?
Well, last month, our colleague, KPBS North County reporter Tanya Thorne, she released this video series, the series called Where's My Village, about childcare and the costs and how often inaccessible it is and just how it's kind of a broken industry. One thing, you know, she was on Roundtable last month, and one thing she brought up was just this idea of more workplaces providing childcare. And there's a Wall Street Journal piece about this, and it profiles a coffee company, Red Rooster Coffee in Virginia, and just about their effort. They found it's really hard to kind of retain workers and things. So one thing they decided, they opened a child care facility. And I think employees pay into it. They say, you know, virtually all their employees that have kids or had kids have participated in it. But they had to hire a teacher. You know, there's a lot of like regulations with it. I just thought it was really interesting. And it did note that, you know, they are seeing an uptick in the number of companies that offer childcare, you know, for employees. So another sort of, I don't know if it's a full solution to fill in the gaps. Obviously, the government doesn't subsidize childcare the way other countries do. Some other countries in Europe, elsewhere do. But I just thought it was interesting and reminded me of Tanya's great series on that.
Yeah, it absolutely fits in with that for sure. It's wild how expensive childcare is, and especially like infant care and how there are wait lists even before the child's born. I mean, that's just it's crazy how parents have to anticipate that, you know, there's already so much going on for them. So before a child's born, you have to be thinking about, let me get on a wait list so I can make sure that I have care for my child. It is interesting to see private companies taking these steps. It's also a reflection of just the fact that the system or the industry is broken. It's not providing the services that's needed and also the services at a cost that's affordable.
Right. And I guess there are questions of like how efficient that is of a coffee company having to get into the the childcare business. You know, I think it notes that, you know, other people can bring their kids in outside of the company, but I imagine that opens up to a lot of different kind of hoops they need to jump through just to make that work, right? So yeah, it does kind of reflect, like, it doesn't seem to be the ultimate solution.
Yeah, I also imagine in places, in countries where childcare is part of, you know, what's provided by the government, they would be looking at something like that and scratching their heads and saying, what a weird thing for a coffee company or any other private company to have to, you know, stand up their own childcare for their employees. Moving on. Andrew, give me your 2 cents on 99-cent stores.
Yeah, this was the Los Angeles Times did this article on the history of, you know, this Los Angeles company, 99-cent only stores. They're closing their doors, and there's about 20 of them in San Diego County. But this LA Times piece by Andrea Chang and Lawrence Darmiento kind of tells the whole story of founder David Gold and, you know, how he kind of just had this idea of like, oh, this was a magic number to sell things at and just to sell everything at 99 cents. But it also became a very large company, grew out, you know, far beyond California. And something that I think is coming out in some of the reporting on this is that it's also, you know, something that a lot of communities, particularly low-income communities, have relied on these stores. They may be in food deserts or not have available, you know, shopping. And it's provided a pretty important service for some low-income communities. And now they filed for bankruptcy last weekend, and the stores are going to be closing. They're doing, like, going out of business sales now, and I think they're expected to end later this month.
That was the first thing I thought of, was how these stores, these dollar stores, have been supplanting for years traditional grocery stores, especially in, like you said, lower income communities, more rural communities. And it seems like as that's unfolded over the years, now suddenly there's this big change that's going to happen, because also Family Dollar said that they're going to be closing nearly 1,000 stores nationwide. So these stores that have popped up that are selling, you know, limited goods at very cheap, that have, you know, like I said, replaced a lot of those more traditional stores and, you know, grocery stores. I'm just worried about those communities and if the rug will be pulled out from under them, and if they've been relying on a dollar store for groceries, which arguably isn't the best place to be buying, say, fresh produce. Where are they going to go now?
Yeah, that's the big question, is what's going to replace that. ABC News 10 did an interesting story, and it talked to, you know, some of these longtime customers and some of their frustrations and concerns with, you know, what they're going to do when these stores leave their neighborhoods.
Well, that's our weekly roundup. Andrew Bracken, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks for tuning in to KPBS Roundtable. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at roundtable@kpbs.org or leave us a message at 619-452-0228. You can also listen to our show anytime as a podcast. KPBS Roundtable airs on KPBS-FM at noon on Fridays and again Sundays at 6 a.m. Roundtable is produced by Andrew Bracken. Rebecca Chacon is our technical producer. Brooke Ruth is our senior producer. And I'm Scott Rodd. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Maya Tribulsi, news anchor for KPBS Evening Edition. At KPBS, we're storytellers, providing trusted, accurate news and information to our community. But not everyone realizes how important that is. And that's why we're asking you to tell that story during Public Media Giving Days. Share what inspires you on KPBS. Text, call, or post with hashtag Public Media Gives. And thanks.